The U.S. launches a fourth strike against the Houthis in Yemen as the Houthis vow to continue their attacks on Red Sea shipping, making the case for Ukraine aid at the White House.
This will be an opportunity for the president and for the national security team to make sure that members of Congress fully understand the desperate, urgent need for weapons and capabilities for Ukraine.
And the most expensive perfumes in the world get a main ingredient from a remote island in the Indian Ocean.
The rare ylang, ylang oil, which is used in major perfume brands.
Today is Thursday, January 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. The United States and Britain conducted another round of strikes against Houthi targets in Yemen on Wednesday. Joining us now is VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Seldon. So, what do we know about this new attack by the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the Middle East and South Asia, confirmed late Wednesday night, U.S. time, that it has carried out strikes against 14 Houthi missile launchers or locations where the Houthis had missiles that had been loaded onto launch rails and were ready to be fired. They said that these missiles presented an imminent threat to merchant ships in the region, in the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, as well as to U.S. Navy vessels. And officials tell us that the strikes were carried out. U.S. Navy vessels launched missiles to take out these targets and to protect ships in the area. Of course, this comes just hours after the Houthis were launched another attack against a U.S.-owned and operated carrier that was in the Gulf of Aden. They used a one-way attack drone in that case. Damage was caused, but there weren't any injuries reported. But clearly, the U.S. is taking a very close look at Houthi activity, and for the second time now in the past several days, has now conducted preemptive strikes to make sure that Houthi missiles and drones do not hit or target any ships operating in the area.
So obviously the United States is taking a more aggressive stance, both diplomatically and with the military, designating the Houthis as a terrorist organization, and now four subsequent attacks on their infrastructure, yes?
The U.S. has been, and its allies, and the key point here is that the U.S. has carefully courted allies in this effort. Remember, just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. with 12 other nations sent a letter, essentially, demanding that the Houthis stop and that warning them that they would not be getting any other warnings, that additional attacks on merchant shipping, of which there have been about 30 since mid-November, had to stop. And if they didn't stop, that there would be action that was taken. The U.S. followed that up the other week with about 30 strikes on about 60 targets in 16 different locations, which they said, officials have said, severely degraded Houthi capabilities. And now there are additional strikes. And again, this week, twice now, the U.S. has carried out preemptive strikes when U.S. intelligence and assets have determined that the Houthis were preparing to launch missiles or drones at ships. And the U.S. and its allies have taken action to make sure that doesn't happen. But clearly, this could be an escalation. And the other question is, how long or what needs to happen before the Houthis start to reconsider what they are doing? It seems so far that the actions the U.S. and its allies have taken have not served as deterrence. Every time there's an action, so far the Houthis have responded. At the Pentagon today, a spokesman was saying that Houthis have to ask themselves how much of their capability they want to see destroyed. From the Houthis' point of view, though, perhaps the question is how much can they keep doing without losing so much of their capabilities that they're deterred? The Houthis rejected came out today with strong statements saying that despite the U.S. designations and the U.S. actions, they weren't going to change their position. And analysts who VOA has spoken with have told us that in some ways, the Houthis see these designations and these actions by the U.S. and its allies as a badge of honor, which means that they're doing the things that are going to get them attention and support from their supporters, from their fans, and quite possibly from Iran. So whether or not this eases, whether there's any de-escalation going forward, at least in the interim, seems to be a very big question.
VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Iran is the main protagonist in the Middle East, with affiliates, or as some would call them, proxies like the Houthis, being supplied and encouraged by Tehran. Joining us now to talk about this is Stephen Simon, a visiting professor of practice in Middle East studies at the University of Washington. He served as the National Security Council Senior Director for Counterterrorism in the Clinton White House and for the Middle East and North Africa in the Obama White House, and in senior positions at the U.S. Department of State. They're fighting this multi-front war with everybody, their neighbors, the West. What do they want?
Yeah, they certainly are pugnacious. I think they want to maximize their regional influence. You know, probably as a strategic matter, but there's a very strong ideological component. You know, to their interest here, especially as it relates to Israel, and that's that imperative, that ideological, impulse. You know, is regulating, you know, their overall strategy. And the U.S., you know, angle is linked to this because, you know, the U.S. is a big supporter of Israel and so forth. The U.S. is a big supporter of the conservative monarchies in the Gulf. And the U.S. Was involved in Iranian politics in ways that it should not have been. And one could argue ways that backfired, you know, on the United States and the West generally. So the United States is also kind of in Iran's gun sights, you know, for this reason. But with Israel, it's thoroughly ideological, because the Israelis, you know, if these two countries don't border one another. I mean, the Iranians are so interested in Lebanon and in Syria now because what they want to do is be up against Israel's borders. You know, they don't like being so far away from Israel. I mean, in this perverse sense, because if you're so far away, your enemy is harder to kill. You know, their enemy is harder to kill, but. Because they are in practice so far away, the Israelis have never threatened Iran, you know, Iranian security or what have you.
And what about the Israelis in that dynamic?
As far as the Israelis are concerned, they just as soon have nothing to do with Iran, period. You know, there's this... I'm trying to remember the director of this movie. It's a brilliant, brilliant movie. It's an early Spielberg movie. It's an early Spielberg movie where there's this guy. He's driving down the highway, and it's this enormous truck that's tailgating him.
Oh, I know that movie. Sure. It's called Duel.
Well, that's like Israel and Iran. Iran is like this truck that keeps tailgating, you know, this country that all they want to do is just get away from it and just do their own thing.
So is that what Iran wants?
The Iranians have this fixation, and it's really it's kind of nutty. Now so there's an opportunity now for the Iranians to advance, you know, their objective of hassling Israel and the United States. But the Iranians, you know, they're not suicidal. So they're doing so in these pinprickish ways. So launching some volleys at American bases in Iraq, you know, that don't actually kill anyone. when they launch a missile, you know, into Iraqi Kurdistan, you know, they go out of their way to say, well, they weren't targeting the consulate. There's a new consulate in Erbil. They were targeting an Israeli installation. In Syria, they just use proxies, and their attacks against U.S. forces are largely, you know, ineffective. In the Red Sea, they work through the Houthis. I mean, the Houthis have their own axe to grind. You know, so and what the Houthis are doing is as much a function of internal Houthi politics as it is their relations, as it has to do with their relations with Iran, or, you know, their, you know, deep feelings of kinship with the Palestinian people.
Stephen Simon from the University of Washington. We're following these other stories from around the world. Zambia reeling from a major cholera outbreak that has killed more than 400 people and infected more than 10,000, leading authorities to order schools across the country to remain shut after the end-of-year holidays. A large soccer stadium in the capital city has been converted into a treatment facility. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak defeated a rebellion among his Conservative Party on Wednesday, lawmakers voting 320 to 276 in favor of approving his plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda. Here's British Interior Minister James Cleverly.
This bill sends an unambiguously clear message that if you enter the United Kingdom illegally, you cannot stay.
Under the plan, migrants who arrive in Britain illegally face being sent to Rwanda, which is about 6,400 kilometers away, to have their asylum claims processed. A senior official of Moldova's pro-European government said on Wednesday that his latest talks with the pro-Russian separatists Transnistria region has been quite difficult, as tensions are rising in the three-decade-old standoff. The region split from Moldova before the collapse of Soviet rule and fought a brief war against the newly independent state, which sits between Ukraine and Romania. In a new report, CARE International says events in Africa are being underreported in the media as global attention shifts to conflicts in Europe and the Middle East. The charity identifies 10 African nations confronting humanitarian challenges from hunger, violence, climate change, and others, but gets little news coverage. Mohamed Youssef reports.
The report released last week took the unusual approach of aggregating online articles in Arabic, English, French, German, and Spanish. It found there were more than 215,000 articles last year about Prince Harry's book Spare, but only 11,000 about the deadly violence and displacement in Burkina Faso. There were more than 273,000 articles about the Barbie film, but only 1,000 about the floods, drought, and hunger in Angola that affected some 7 million people. The report, titled Breaking the Silence, mentions many other African crises that are getting little to no media attention. Stefan Brand works with CARE Germany. He explains why the continent's humanitarian crisis is underreported.
I think that big crises, big conflicts, such as the war in Ukraine or now in the Middle East, are receiving the most coverage by international journalists in every country or in most of the countries. And therefore, smaller crises are more in the shadow of these big conflicts. But I also think that media channels are more forced to save money because of the lack of interest by public.
CARE International's research singled out 10 African countries, including Zimbabwe, Uganda, Burundi, Zambia, and Senegal. that are suffering crises such as climate change, conflict, poverty, widespread hunger and political instability. It said more than 77,000 articles were published last year about these countries, while the iPhone 15 generated more than 273,000 stories. Douglas Okwach is the secretary of the Foreign Press Association Africa, an organization of African journalists working for foreign media. He says media budgets have been shrinking, reducing the number of stories being produced from the continent.
I think post-COVID, countries globally really are constrained in terms of resources, you know. And then therefore, many countries, particularly the ones that own this big international media, are looking at where to cut, you know, budgets. And probably the media is one of the places or the easiest places to cut budgets. And when you cut budgets, then that have a direct implication on coverage.
International media's closure of foreign bureaus also is blamed for the underreporting and fatigue that has set in after decades of unending conflicts and humanitarian crisis in some African countries. Some critics have accused foreign media of focusing more on Africa's conflict and suffering than its potential and contribution to the world. Okwach, who is also a journalist, says other sectors and global competition for Africa's resources and support are getting more coverage than the humanitarian crisis.
Cannot just focus on the humanitarian, the fewer, the lesser humanitarian stories, and think that things in Africa are on a downward spiral in terms of focus on Africa. I think if there's less coverage on humanitarian crisis, probably the coverage has also shifted towards economic interests and geopolitical interests.
Brand says access to African countries and investment in stable media can improve coverage in Africa.
I think in general, governments need to give journalists access to the countries and especially the crisis of the region, so reporters and journalists can report on these crises. Foreign media needs to pay more attention. Accept more pictures from African journalists, freelancers, from countries, foreign countries, African countries, and media needs to invest in a good, stable journalism, foreign correspondents, freelancers, and local partners.
The United Nations says more than 300 million people will need humanitarian assistance in 2024, but half of them in Africa. CARE International calls for the media to tell African humanitarian crisis stories so aid agencies and relevant authorities can take urgent action to save the situation. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. On aid for Ukraine, there was a meeting at the White House on Wednesday with the administration and Democratic and Republican lawmakers. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby emphasized the critical and urgent need for the assistance.
This will be an opportunity for the president and for the national security team to make sure that members of Congress fully understand the desperate, urgent need for weapons and capabilities for Ukraine.
U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican, said they still want more for the U.S. border before they can agree to more for Ukraine and Israel.
We had a productive meeting, I think, House and Senate leaders. The president was very forthright. I told the president what I have been saying for many months, and that is that we must have change at the border, substantive policy change. We're not insistent upon a particular name of a piece of legislation, but we are insistent that the elements have to be meaningful. The House is ready to act, but the legislation has to solve the problem.
In Davos, French President Macron said,
"Premièrement, nous allons tout faire pour essayer de tenir le monde ensemble."
Well, what he's saying is, first, we're going to have to do everything to try to hold the world together and not give in to the risk of division, and to try to have an effective agenda that will ensure that Russia cannot and must not win in Ukraine. And finally, if you use a fine perfume or you give it as a gift, you might not know that one of its main ingredients comes from the remote Comoros Island in the Indian Ocean. It's a special kind of oil, and the people who make it, were looking for a bigger piece of the profits, as we hear in this report from Rudd Elmendorp.
The Comore Islands are home to fine fragrances, but the most valuable of these is the rare ylang-ylang oil, which is used in major perfume brands. Mahmoud Aboud is one of the many perfume distillers in the region. The 64-year-old businessman says ylang-ylang flower oil used to be a lucrative commodity.
Since COVID, the production has gone very low because of COVID and other major reasons, depending on the international market.
Comoros' ailing economy is heavily reliant on fisheries and bananas, while its tourist potential remains untapped. People in the Comores are hoping President Azali Assoumani, who was re-elected this week, will do more to grow the economy. Mariama Ali Abduku is a 47-year-old mother of five. She just has voted. She says she wants better education, and she expects the new president to do this. To boost their and the country's fortunes, ylang-ylang distillers like Mahmoud Aboud suggest a better positioning of their oil on the international market.
When you plant it in the Comoros, it's very special because you get an oil that you cannot get it anywhere in the world. Like you get five qualities of the oil, but the super extra and the extra which is used in high-end perfume, you only get it in the Comoros.
The World Bank says the oil producers pump $20 million into the Comoros economy. But perfume brands like Chanel and others make a much larger profit from the oil. Mahmoud Aboud is adding more value to his oil by upgrading it into a perfume that is sold in Dubai, thereby making his flowers and distillation worth more.
If you make the perfume and the people will understand that this is a product which is coming from the Comoros, many people will come and buy directly from us instead of buying from the trader somewhere in France.
The Comoros ylang-ylang oil distillers hope they can use the hidden value of their work to bring a sophisticated touch and a fresh-smelling future to the remote island group. Ruth Elmendorp for VOA News, Moroni, Comoros.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At a press conference during his latest visit to Cairo, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that though it is a difficult task, regional states and U.S. partners in the Arabic world are committed to finding a resolution to the Gaza crisis that will start the region on a longer-term path to genuine peace and stability.
That path is clearly there. It's possible, and we can see it. There's a path that brings Israel's needs and desires for integration in the region and genuine security with, as well, the Palestinian aspirations for a state of their own.
These two things are tied together. Israel's integration, its security, pathway to a Palestinian state, that is the equation. And it has to be done on a regional basis with regional commitments, all of which I believe countries are prepared to take, said Secretary Blinken.
From Israel's perspective, if you can have a future where they're integrated into the region, relations are normalized with other countries, where they have the necessary assurances, commitments, guarantees for their security, that's a very attractive pathway. But it's also clear that that requires a pathway to a Palestinian state. We've heard that from every single country in the region.
None of this is easy, to say the least, after so many years. None of this will happen overnight, said Secretary Blinken. But there is a greater willingness now of countries to make the hard decisions and do what's necessary to advance on that track. And I think you can really see two very stark alternatives for the region.
One is an alternative where you have an integrated region with Israel, integrated with security assurances and commitments from regional countries and as well from the United States and a Palestinian state, at least a pathway to get to that state. The other path is to continue to see the terrorism, the nihilism, the destruction by Hamas by the Houthis, by Hezbollah, all backed by Iran.
If you pursue the first path, if you build that integration, if you bring Israel in, if you make the necessary commitments to security, and you move down the path to a Palestinian state, said Secretary Blinken, there is a pathway forward, and it's one that we fully intend to pursue with American diplomacy in the weeks and months ahead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.